to the Big Web Show. I am your host, Hieronymus Bosch, and with me today is Jen Simmons of The Web Ahead. Hi, Jen.
Hello. I was expecting, I don't know, more of a something. I'm glad.
I'll tell you the dream again. I dreamed I was doing this. This show's been on hiatus for a while, and we're getting back in the swing of things now, and you're the guest that I chose to start this with. But I had it in my head, but I hadn't actually invited you. So I dreamed that we were doing the show, and there was another web person, like somebody we know through the internet, said he had this clever idea where at a certain point we could bring all these other people in. Like other people who had interesting things to say. And we could, and I said, that seems like it would be really complicated to do on the air. And he said, no, I can handle it. I've got a mixing board and all these mics. So he started bringing in other web people. And soon there were so many, they started singing, they were out of control. The group took over this town in Canada, this whole city in Canada. It was just it was like Woodstock of
of podcasting.
Podcasting, yes.
That's funny.
Everyone was talking at once, and I felt like no one could hear what you had to say.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, I'm honored to be here, having you being invited to be back.
Cool. You are best known at this time for doing The Web Ahead. What made you go into podcasting?
You. You invited me to be on your show. Which episode was that now? It was a long time ago, like 4 years ago.
And you said, oh my God, I could do this so much better than he's doing it?
No. So I met you, and then I was on your show.
It was around the Drupal stuff.
Yeah, must have been 2011, 2000.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, I have a big background in performance and in sound mixing and all this. And I had a microphone. I had bought a microphone to do voiceovers for a documentary project. And so I was using it to be on the show. And then Dan Benjamin, who used to be on the show with you, he was like, "What? Where'd you get that mic? You want to be on this other show with me?" So I was on the Daily Edition with Dan for 34 episodes.
Wow.
Before he stopped doing that show, we co-hosted it for a while.
What was the Daily Edition?
The Daily Edition was similar to the...
I know what it was. It's like the Daily Show, but for tech and Apple, especially Apple and internet.
Yeah, it was 1 hour a day, 5 days a week. So it was a great way to just do podcasting every day. We just chat about whatever, sometimes technology, sometimes other things like paleo or meditation or,
into that, or are you?
I'm not into paleo. But I am into eating well, eating good food.
Yeah.
Healthy food. You know, like real food, not, fake food. But anyway, so then when that show ended, he invited me to start my own show, and I said yes. So I knew I wanted to do a show about HTML5 and other things, but I also knew not to call it the HTML5 show, because that was going to expire at some point. That would
right.
be like, oh, duh, HTML5 is so yesterday.
The Netscape 2.0 show.
Right. So I started The Web Ahead, which is... has been really great.
It's really smart. It has kind of an O'Reilly ring to it, right? Like the Next Web and stuff, but just generally it has a very smart, it's a very smart show. I love your show. And it's also, the branding of it is very clear. The promise of it is very clear.
Thanks.
Smart. Yeah.
Carolyn Wood helped me quite a bit with that and like clarifying in my own mind exactly what I wanted to do and not what I wanted to do, but how I wanted to tell the story of what, like, just putting into words what it is that the show already was, I guess.
Carolyn Wood is everywhere. She's behind so many great things.
She is. She's like the secret. You see something and you're like, wow, that's so awesome and so smart and so clear. And so I know exactly what that is. Yeah, probably Carolyn Wood helped.
Had a hand in it. She's like the secret sauce.
She is a secret sauce.
She's the cilantro.
Right.
Jesus, my intro.
So when I built the website for the show this past winter, I would show her stuff and she'd be like, yeah, that's not what we talked about. You should make that more whatever we had talked about. And I'd be like,
that's
the
thing I love and hate about editors. I love and hate them for the same reason. I so admire them, but then their clarity starts to annoy me. I have this all the time with A List Apart, with the brilliant editors there, led by Sarah Watcher-Betcher. And I'm just like, I have this great idea for a feature. And she's like, yeah, and how is that going to advance the things we talked about? And I just feel like I'm 3 years old. Right. I want corn. I wanted corn with Dada, you know.
No, I love it because it's someone who can kind of just say, hey, you told me a while ago that this is what you wanted, and now you're not doing that. And it's like, oh, right. I forgot. How did I? I forgot again. Thank you for reminding me what it is that I...
It's like a creative director / project manager hybrid in a strange way.
Yeah.
Right? They just sort of keep you to it.
Yeah.
It's great. And we know what happens when creative people go off the leash. We get, you know, Apocalypse Now, right? You know that story where they actually went crazy in the jungle.
All right.
For real, on cocaine.
Yeah, because it's exciting. There's so many things you can do, and the tools that we have at our fingertips make it so easy. It's like, yeah, let's go make a movie, and yeah, we'll do this too, and we'll start this thing, and we'll do this other thing, and then you end up getting nothing done.
When you designed and built the Web Ahead website at thewebahead.net, I mean, you didn't need to do that because 5x5 is already has, you know, a Web Ahead section. So what was your goal? What was the idea behind doing it? Like, why did you want to make a website for a podcast that technically didn't, although it's nice, didn't need one? What were you trying to achieve? What was your goal?
Yeah, it's funny because, you know, there's a lot of people talking about podcasts these days, and you see new ones popping up all the time, especially some, you know, not tech world people, but like other people. And they seem to have this idea that like, oh, you don't need a website. Everybody uses an app to subscribe to a podcast. You know, the web is really not important. And I had the opposite sense. I was like, no, the web, I think it's very important for every project, no matter what it is, to have a home on the web, because that's how people are going to find it and discover it and share it and understand it. And you're right. It's been on the 5x5.tv website since it started, and that creates the RSS feed, and that's the place where people can go to see the show notes. But it didn't feel like it had its own home. It felt like it was, you know, just a little
sleeping
section
on someone's couch.
Yeah, right.
It's a really nice couch. They're fantastic hosts.
Right.
They never kick you out. They don't mind if you raid the refrigerator.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And I also, there was this giant back catalog with, at the time, I guess I was getting up to 70 or 80 shows. And now I have 102. Two and a half. There's almost 103. And people couldn't find the older shows, right? So you find, I don't know, you go to a conference and you see this person who's named Jen and you say, oh, well, let me go check out her podcast. So you find it, I guess, in the iTunes store or in the podcast app of your choice. You subscribe. You can, from those places, then download 100 episodes, but that's intimidating and a bit like, wow, that's, I don't know.
And I wanted, like, the biggest hard drive on your device. I mean, you'd have to have a device. Most devices don't have the room for that. That's why.
Yeah. Or, cloud. I mean, how many hours of that? It's like 150 hours of. Now, people do download the entire back catalog, but it's a big commitment.
It's the problem we ran into when we were blogging, right? And you'll probably run into it with the website, too. It's like you say something really great this one time, and the next day you write some crappy thing, and the next day you don't write. And eventually, someone's like, you remember that great thing you wrote about that thing? You know, like, I have no idea where it is. And we don't have any way, you know, we can Google, hopefully the way you wrote it, with enough keywords, you can find it. But there's no way to surface that on your own website, right? There's no way.
Yeah, well, and what I wanted is I wanted people to be able to say, I care a lot about design. I like this podcast. I want to go see the episodes about design.
So you set up this topic hierarchy.
Yeah. So people can go look, and you want to listen to all the shows about CSS? Great. You want to see all the shows that talk about accessibility? These are the ones. You want to focus on responsive web design? Here's a list of, you know, whatever, it's 6 or 8 or probably more than that. But this, you know, these particular episodes are going to really get into that topic. And so start there.
You set up landing pages for each topic.
Yeah.
Where you describe like what the topic is about. And did you actually hand curate these particular? When you pick like designing for crisis with Eric Meyer under accessibility and advanced accessibility with Derek Featherstone, are those just the most recent ones than the algorithms finding them, or are you hand curating this page?
When I add an episode, I have a bunch of information for each episode. If you go to the page for the episode, a lot of the content that's been entered for that episode is not on this page. So if you look at episode 69, WCAG and Accessibility with Luke McGrath, there's nothing on here that says, oh wait, yes there is. It says filed under accessibility down at the bottom. That's true.
No, I know the mechanics. I think all the listeners know the mechanics of tagging something and then having an algorithm just grab it. Right. I was just curious whether that's what you were doing with your landing pages. Okay.
Or that's what I'm saying.
Because sometimes with the list of fire, we, you know, obviously you can go to a topic page and things that are tagged, but we've talked on and off for years about actually curating each of those topics so that if you're a beginner, there'd be like, these are the articles you should read. If you're not grounded in this particular discipline, this technology, whatever the subject is, then you should maybe read this stuff first and then go here. It's a lot of work, obviously.
Yeah. I mean, in these topic pages, honestly, I got to this place where I just needed to ship the website. It was just dragging on. So I'm not happy with them at all. They look kind of lame. The layout is completely boring. It's just like a blog with a reverse chronological order list of shows. But it's usable. It's useful, I think. And when I have a chance, I'll go back. And this is one of the things I want to really sit down and say, okay, how do I really want to design these pages?
Well, layout is something you've been talking a lot about, and I want to get to that. But before I do, I'm just curious, what are the mechanics of, if you have your own website for a podcast that's also on the, you know, but the podcast is on the 5x5 network, how much is everything in the same database somewhere, like on a 5x5 server, and you're pulling it?
No, I wish. So
there's a lot of duplication.
It's total duplication at this point. I'd like to switch that around. What about the audio files? The audio files are on the 5x5 system, the CDN. So my website, the web ahead, just references those URLs.
Okay, so you're not even pulling them. You're linking to them, or you're
I'm looking to them because they're not even like at 5x5, there's sort of several different systems and several layers to the cake. And one of them is the website with the content management system. But even there, it's just pointing to the server stack that's got the audio files. Those are decoupled actually. So I just mirrored that.
But those for people who don't know, and that includes me because I'm confused. When someone's grabbing our podcast files from Apple via iTunes,
they
don't get them from Apple. They get them from 5x5.
Apple just has the feed. No.
So Apple's like an RSS reader for iTunes.
Yes. Yep. Apple's just hosting the RSS feed, and then there's a URL so that when you're in iTunes, or, you know, it works exactly the same. There's all these different podcast apps that just scrape the iTunes store, and they're just taking the RSS feed right out of the iTunes store. So they're all just passing around these links.
They still have the burden of hosting everything.
And it's hosted. It's not on one server in a closet somewhere. There's, you know, it's on a CDN, and there's a whole system for collecting statistics. And so even the URLs that we're pointing at are not actually where the files are stored. They're redirected a couple times before they end up wherever the files really are.
We've talked about it before, but like your background is, you know, you were in theater and everything, but you're also very technical. And how did those two worlds come together for you, if you don't mind? I mean, I could listen to this stuff endlessly, and a lot of people don't.
Oh, yeah. No, it's boring.
It's not boring, but a lot of people don't know. Like, you were in the theater doing everything but act.
Yeah. Yeah, I've always been I've always wanted to make stuff. And in order to make stuff, I've always pursued figuring out how it gets made and understanding the technology that's needed to do it, whether that's a computer or whether that's something physical like wires and cables and lights. And it's always felt very natural to me to pursue a deeper understanding of that medium, whichever one it is, with an ability to express things artistically, figure out, okay, what is it that I want to say in this moment? And then how am I going to say it? And artistically, how are we going to, you know, design something that's going to work for the intention that we've set? And then, okay, well, here's the tech that you need to implement it. Okay, yeah, no big deal. Like, I can't come up with these ideas if I don't have the ability to implement them.
Right, like, you can't invent overdubbing if you don't have a tape recorder. Right, Les Paul invented overdubbing, but he had a multi-track tape recorder.
Right.
He had a two-track. I guess he had a two-track, and he figured out how to ping-pong back and forth.
And I think it's actually very... I think that is a very natural way to manipulate technology, whatever, you know, whether it's... whatever it is. And I think it's only very recently, or the last 50 years, perhaps, that humanity has come up with this situation where we've separated out... we've lost craftsmanship, and we've separated out sort of the person who decides what the thing should be from the, oh, poor slobs who actually have to go build it. And, you know, oh, the architect and their fanciness, but they don't actually understand any of the building materials. So we end up with these terrible stains of rust and leaky roofs and such versus, you know, oh, these people, these like people who undocumented immigrants who get paid crap and have no safety situation going on are the ones who are going to actually build the thing, right? Like it used to be that
about that abstraction from work, that was Henry Ford. He made the assembly line. Before that, right, you'd be a craftsperson and you'd sit and make a violin, and you'd spend 3 months, 6 months, whatever it took, making that violin.
Yeah.
And so, and you know, if cars were made that way, like I think Rolls Royces they would cost a fortune. But instead, you know, you spend all day turning a certain nut, and the next person turns another nut, So, but it's interesting because the web, I mean, the tool always shapes the work, right? So we use paint for thousands of years for hundreds of years trying to emulate the real world. Well, first, we expressed religion with paint. Then after the Renaissance, artists actually tried to depict the real world with shadows and everything that was in the world.
Yeah. You know,
before that, it was sort of forbidden to put perspective in. It was too close to God's creation, sacrilegious. And then, you know, ultimately we had modern art where the medium was, you know, the strokes became more and more important. You wanted to see the painter's hand, all the stuff that painters had tried to hide was now being shown. And I think that happens with web stuff all the time, where first we're emulating some older medium using tools that have nothing to do with that. You know, like we're emulating printed books or emulating newspapers or emulating TV.
Yeah.
Right. On the web using different technologies. And then we start getting fascinated with the technologies themselves and we go, hey, well, this layout could be responsive, right? It doesn't have to be fixed. I mean, people have been saying that for 20 years, all 20 years, but it took a designer saying it and having it not suck for people to go, oh, right. Oh, it actually does work. Yeah. I mean, it was one thing when an angry developer said everything should be liquid.
Well, I think there's a big difference between liquid and responsive.
There is,
simply in that because you have these conditionals, the media queries, you can say, you can change change things at a certain size. So you don't end up with super long line lengths. And
right.
Yeah. And that made all the difference in the world, the media query.
Again, what I'm going to say is it took a designer. It took a designer to look at the same question and go, yeah, okay, so obviously we don't want endless line lengths. And we obviously, you know, but so what do we do? How do we acknowledge the plasticity of the web and of devices, but still have something that's designed?
Yeah, it's interesting the interplay between what's possible technologically and what, you know, having a vision for a design and that sort of back and forth and back and forth.
Yeah.
Because it's sometimes we do focus way too much on the technology and we focus way too much on the code and we aren't actually asking some of the deeper questions of what is this medium as a design medium? What is this medium as an artistic medium, as art? And what could we be making with it? And what are we making with it? And many times we have very commercial projects. So great. Okay. We got to meet these commercial needs and these business needs. But where I feel like the medium is still so young, and I'd like to see more people, and I'd like to have more conversations about us discussing the medium itself as a medium separate, completely separate from the technology.
I mean, I don't think you just want to, you know, storyboard everything and then shoot exactly what you storyboard and ignore what a camera can do. Right. Right. And I don't think Jimi Hendrix had a sound in his head and then he, you know, got his fuzz pedal and his wah-wah pedal. And it's like he was playing with one sound in his head. And then when he started messing with the wah-wah pedal, he said, oh, I can. And he changed the kind of music he was writing, the way he was playing. And then that changed the way the bass player and the drummer were playing. Right. And it changed what could be a song. And then you get, you know, the no wave groups, where it was just pure distortion. Right. It was like shouting and distortion and everything. And it all came out of it. It became a certain kind of noise music was made possible because of technology.
Right. But playing with the technology. I mean, I guess I shouldn't say separate from the technology, because you're right. That's not what I meant. I guess I mean, because we'll have endless conversations about build tools and about, you know, which method of writing your code is going to be more performant, and, you know, which JavaScript framework is the better one to use, and none, or, you know, those kinds of debates, which are important debates to have. I don't mean to diss them. We've got to have those debates, but those debates are not a substitute for conversations that let us understand the medium more deeply, or play with the technology, not just for the sake of understanding how to get good performance or how to get great build, or, you know, build tools, or how to deploy faster, but to play, just to understand the medium.
And then have the thoughts that, you know, you may not actually want an Apple Watch, but if you don't get it, you might not have the thought of a design idea that only comes when you've been wearing some little piece of, you know, when you've had a computer strapped to your wrist for 6 months and aren't even.
That's why I bought one day one. That's why I had day one. You just need to play with it. You need to understand it. It's why I get so frustrated when I work on projects where the design has been given to somebody else and they don't know anything about CSS, and their quote unquote design deliverables are documents that don't reflect the fact that we're building a website, where they are much more the kind of design deliverables that you might get if we were doing print design.
Who are you? What, I guess you can't say, but so those are freelance gigs that you're doing?
I haven't had
with
those,
like,
gigs
ad agencies or something
more recently, but yeah. I've worked when I was working 3-4 years ago or so as a front end developer. More commonly, I would end up. Typically big agencies, not ad agencies, but just, you know, web agencies here in New York. Just
big web agencies in New York that didn't know what they were doing?
Yeah, they just churn out PDFs, you know, and there's no hover color, there's no information about what to do when the content is different lengths, because every bit of content on that PDF is exactly the same length as every other bit of content, you know. So the developers end up doing finishing a lot of the design, because they're figuring all this stuff out. Now, you know, I guess if you're doing a website that's very much like 80% of the other websites that are out there, and you're just sort of copying design patterns that are seen every single day, then some of the choices are a little obvious. You know, if you're copying Facebook, I mean, I had someone tell me when I went to the designer and said, well, how do you want this to behave, pointing to their PDF? And they were like, oh yeah, I just got that from Facebook. Just go open up Facebook and look at how they do it and do it like that. You know, it's like, that's why I stopped working as a developer.
That makes me very sad.
Yeah, it's so frustrating. That's why I was like, I have to get back on the design side. This was 5 years ago now, but I just was like, I can't.
You have to do both. Did you see the discussion a few days ago about the developer who was explaining that users should just get used to the fact that in an app, a back button doesn't take you back? They should just get used to it taking you wherever. Like, don't impede my creativity as a developer, you stupid user with your expectation, was kind of the conversation. And it can be frustrating when someone's convinced of that, right?
Well, and what happened to the playing around and discovering what the medium can do that we were doing 15 years ago.
Like, well, I think that's happening in the app world now. I think that's happening in the app world now, but there is a downside. So the great thing is people are inventing, they're going, oh, if, you know, I think in the app world, people are thinking more about touch. They're, on the web, there's all kinds of assumptions we can't necessarily make, and we don't know if the person interacting with our website, if their device will support touch events or not, and so on and so forth. I think at this point we have to assume that some people, some users will have that, so you've got to include it. But you know, with apps, you know the device, you know the capabilities of the device, and you can design for that. And I think there's a lot of Wild West creativity for good and for ill. So there's lots of new invention, and there's lots, but there's also lots of really weird interfaces, or like a pretty good camera app, except it takes 7 steps to do something that everyone else knows how to do in 1 step, or it's a really interesting app, except they use the built-in WebKit browser, which lacks some features of a real WebKit browser, or when you try to back out of the browser, you don't go back where you were. You go like 2 steps up, or you go to some random place. I mean, there's a lot of,
yeah.
I think we had a Wild West 15 years ago, and we've matured.
Yeah,
most of us. But in apps, it's like, you know, it's super young people, you know, right out of school. Not to say all young people don't care, and not to be like the old crab complaining about old people, young people, but. But I think there it's sort of some one person said a great thing. He said that's what usability testing is for, and it's weird. It's like it's not just to I think it's not just to reveal unforeseen errors. It's to prove that you're arrogant. It's to prove that your assumptions are, you know, when you see someone struggling with something you made, it's a little different. You can't be quite as arrogant. You can't say, well, the user should just get used to it. When you see them struggling, and you go, yeah. Oh wow, and I'm not going to be there to help them. Oh, that's yeah. No good. Or if the stakeholder sees them struggling, right? You have this idea, and it seems really neat to you, but people can't use the product as a result, or they're frustrated.
No, it is. I mean, I really like user testing for 2 things, and one is when you're trying to make a case for something because you kind of already know that there's a problem, but you're having a hard time making that case. Yeah. User testing can be a great way to kind of prove that what you're saying is actually true. And the other one is, yeah, we have these ideas and we think it's going to work this way, or we hope it's going to work that way, but you're not sure. And so it is a way to, it's just a matter of, you know, having an audience. Like I missed that in a way from doing theater. When I did theater, opening night came and you stood in the back of the theater and you watched all these decisions that got made and you see how successful they were or not. And there there was no data, you know, it wasn't a scientific study. It was just a feeling, you know, how does the audience feel? Yeah. Nope. Are they laughing? Are they
died?
Yeah. What is the reaction? How is it feeling? And you can kind of be like, yeah, that just the show just didn't come out that well, or did come out. And I don't know that I ever really thought about necessarily that audience feedback consciously, or that we had. I mean, we'd always have these, many times we'd have conversations about the show afterwards, but it was never organized. There wasn't a write-up. There wasn't a report, but it was still all information that I just absorbed and just, it just went into the soup of, I don't know how, wherever it is that stuff comes from. So that over, you know, year after year after year, like there's just more and more soup there to draw from next time you go to make a decision about something. And with the web and with the, you know, any digital apps on the phone or whatever, we rarely get that chance to see the audience. So yeah, you can end up in this sort of closed circuit where you just think you're so awesome and everybody is talking to you about how awesome you are and how successful our project is. And that's so great. And then if you don't actually go put it in front of an audience and see whether or not just meet the audience and see how they're interacting, then you don't have a chance to. I do think this world of designing with data, though, is getting a little out of hand. It worries me. It feels like, you know, let's just drop all of the art altogether and we'll just do science on everything. and we'll just collect data. Yeah. And then we'll make all our decisions based on data. And it's like, okay, first of all, if you're going to do a survey, you need to actually understand how to do a proper sociological study, and you don't have a good sample size, and you don't have enough diversity, and you did your survey where everybody self-selected themselves into your study. It's already wrong. Like, it automatically is going to already fail. Like, there's a lot of science behind doing a proper study. And I see a lot of people doing these quote unquote studies of stuff, and they're really bad. They're so bad. They're just collecting data that's completely false. They have no idea what they're actually getting.
Sometimes it's all you can get, though. As an example, after our conference in Urbana Park, we always ask people who attended, what did you think of the show? What did you think of this session, that session? Right. And how can we make it better? And that's a self-selecting group.
Right.
Right. That's, and it's the people who really loved it, and
the people who really hated it.
Who hated it, and the Cub Scouts, you know, the Girl Scouts, the people who are just really sweet and feel like they should fill out a form because someone vaguely in authority asked them to. Right. Yeah. And that's a self-selecting group. So that's, you know, there's no way.
And you don't get the Twitter's people in the middle who are like, meh.
Right.
And you don't hear from them.
Yeah. Yeah, well, hopefully there's none of them.
Right.
Hopefully
of course there's not. But, there's none.
But you know, and it's weird because Twitter is a different self-selecting group. And so I watch the feed while the conference is going on. And, you know, Twitter may be raving about a presentation, and then a different self-selecting group may have mixed feelings about the same presentation. You're like, it's the same people in the room. But no, it's not. It's not the same individuals. Well, see, again, we're talking about the audience. And it's interesting to me how your background in theater made you a good designer / developer by making you interested to see how users interact with your product. I came from an advertising background where focus groups kind of abused. It was like fake. There was a lot of fake research. Like you'd deliberately, I would, but like an account team might deliberately pick a group that would tell the client what client wanted to hear, or what the agency wanted the client to hear. And this was not a good agency, but it happened at a lot of agencies. And so when I first got into the web, I was like, this is great because we can just make stuff up and we don't have to have focus groups. And when I first heard about usability testing, I was like, no, you know, I had like a knee jerk fear and hatred. Well, also the first usability person I read was Jacob Nielsen. And that was, you know, everything, all links should be blue. And the sidebar should be on the left. If the sidebar's on the right, you're designing badly. And I was just like, actually, I read from left to right. So that feels wrong to me. And, you know, I'm simplifying what he's saying. And I had a very simplified view of what he was saying. But it took me a while to get with usability. And now, of course, I love it because for those two reasons, because it shows me all the things that a user might do that I didn't think of, or they're not doing that I thought surely they would, but also because you can bring it back to that stakeholder and say, the picture on the can of dog food is great, and the name of the dog food is really cute, and the dog models are fantastic, but the dogs won't eat it. The dogs won't eat it. There, look, the dogs are walking away, so some, you know. Okay.
It's got to be really bad food if dogs are going to walk away from it.
That's true. It's hard to find. But yeah.
Oh, it's possible. Yeah.
Cats would have been a better example. We need to take a short break where I thank the people who make this possible. Hang on just a second, Jen. I want to thank DreamHost since 1997. DreamHost, 1997, Jen. They were there at the beginning. Since 1997, DreamHost has helped entrepreneurs and developers the world over bring their dreams to life on the internet. They offer domain registrations, web hosting, and even powerful cloud storage and computing services. They serve 1.5 million plus websites, WordPress blogs, and applications to more than 400,000 customers spanning more than 100 countries. Those are the folks that trust DreamHost to be their online home. DreamHost is packed with unbelievable value, which makes it the best place to launch a blog, website, or web application into the stratosphere. It makes sense. It's very fast. It's inexpensive. It's great. They're home to over 750,000 WordPress installs and have a helpful staff full of professional WordPress experts. So if you want to host WordPress yourself, go, but you're not, you know, you're still new to WordPress, go there, go to DreamHost. DreamHost is the proud winner of PC Magazine's Business Choice Award for Best Web Hosting Service and has been a recommended hosting solution by WordPress.org since 2005. DreamHost offers the hosting solution for individual websites or high-volume enterprise sites and makes it simple to upgrade if your needs change at any time. DreamHost, they have an award-winning in-house support staff that is available to you all day, every day, via live chat and email, 24/7, 365. DreamHost is giving the listeners of this show a special offer. Visit dreamhost.com/thebigwebshow, right? dreamhost.com/thebigwebshow to sign up and make sure to use the code thebigwebshow395 at checkout. That's all caps, right? So dreamhost.com/thebigwebshow, all lowercase. Use the code, all caps, TheBigWebShow395, with a lot, 395 are numerals, obviously. TheBigWebShow395. Use that at checkout, and you'll get top-rated web hosting for just $3.95 a month. I'm going to say that again because it's unbelievable. Top-rated web hosting for just $3.95 a month, plus a free domain name. So thank you, DreamHost, for supporting 5x5 and The Big Web Show. We are very happy that you do. And we're here with Jen Simmons of The Web Ahead. We're talking about design and development and layouts and creativity and the newness of the medium and what happened to the creative spirit, that the innovative spirit on the web. Don't you? Would you say that pendulum swing back and forth, and Jen, and like originally anybody could make a website and that was really cool and people made all kinds of crazy websites and that was really cool and we matured as a medium, so now there's a lot of sameness, cookie cutterness, but eventually it will swing back, maybe not toward anarchy again, but toward a loosening. Do you think, you know, the way people wore bell bottoms and then they certainly did not wear bell bottoms?
I think so. I mean, I think we'll just keep, you know, we'll end up someplace new. And I think sometimes we get into a period where there's a lot of sameness simply because we're all a bit overwhelmed and a bit not sure, like something changes and then we're all like, whoa, and we're trying to catch up with that change and we're trying to understand that change. And so
like with responsive design where we're catching up. We're catching like up to all its implications.
I feel like in some ways it's like, we just stop. We don't have time to like do a bunch of graphic treatment. It'll be white with one block of color and some text. Like, you know, we don't have time to, because we got to think about what to do with the squishiness and the media queries and that we're overwhelmed by that already. Or, you know, we've got all this content. We've really stepped up our game when it comes to content strategy and to figuring out what goes where on the page, but we don't have any bandwidth to think about layout. So we're just going to go with a plain old 12 column, you know, one third, one third, one third, one fourth, one fourth, one fourth rows and rows of boxes. And we don't, you know, we can't think about anything else right now. I understand that completely.
Yeah, I wonder how much of it is what, you know, what people are willing to pay for keeps changing. When we first started doing content strategy at HappyCog, we had to, this is going to sound deceptive, we had to bury it under user experience, because it legitimately is UX research. But we, if we said, you know, 5 years ago, we want to do content strategy, clients would say, what's that? That's ridiculous. We have our content. But if we said we need to do research, they got that. So that's where we put it. And now we don't have to do that. Now we can say content strategy and they get it. Similarly, I would think all but Stone Age clients are, you know, you don't have to justify that you want to do responsive design, right? You just,
right.
It's just in the budget as the thing that adds 400% to the cost.
Well, no, I think at this point, if somebody needed me to do a fix with site, that would add to the cost, because I'd be like, oh, wait, how do you do that again? I don't remember. And so all those wheels that, you know, it used to be people would say, oh, it costs more, but it's because people had to spend time figuring out how it worked. Now I'm like, that's just the default. Everything I have is already set for defaulted responsive and I had to switch back, that would cost me more. It took me more longer.
You're not really doing just one layout though. When you do responsive, you really are thinking about at different breakpoints, should this content move? What happens when the glass gets smaller you're reprioritizing content, you're art directing, the image, like when I have this wide angle shot on the desktop, but I don't want to use that, on a phone, what do I do? And so, more complexity. You're making a design. It's like you're making an animation instead of a flat drawing.
Yeah. Yeah. You're designing a whole system.
You're designing a whole system of changes that have to keep working with each other. And it's kind of infinitely more complex. I mean, if you're doing it right, I think it's infinitely more complex. And maybe that's why there's a lot of cookie cutterness now, because, people figure out a few patterns like the off-screen pattern or the make everything a layer cake, like stack everything on a phone. And then, in other words, and someone figures that out and you're like, okay, well that works. And we don't have time and we don't have a budget. And my boss needs this tomorrow. Yeah. One thing that never changed in the 20 years I've been doing this, it never changes that people need stuff. They come to you when it's too late. They come to you when they need it yesterday.
Yeah.
And they don't include you in the conversation. I mean, the good ones do. Most bosses and a lot of clients won't include you in the conversation until it's kind of too late.
Right. So then that's where I feel like the question comes in. I think it's completely fine. I mean, of course, we're all going to do that. We're all going to ship stuff out the door quickly. We're all going to rely on what we already know, what we've already seen. Clients feel safe with things they've already seen.
Right.
But and designers at some feel point, safe
with design patterns.
Yeah. And design patterns are great. And understanding that, for example, the navigation bar, there was a long time where there was no such thing as a navigation bar. And then we invented the navigation bar. And now we're not going to rethink navigation and completely change it. Users expect there to be a list of links in a horizontal line spanning perhaps the full length of the page and the full width of the page. And that's a thing, right? That's a pattern. That's a design pattern. That's reality. It's a constraint.
It's almost a user understanding pattern as much as it's a design pattern.
Yeah. Yeah. So those, we're going to have all of those things are going to continuously and always be true. Like that's fine. I just feel like when I see someone who maybe has just started their career or, maybe they're 6 years into their career and it's been the entirety of their career that we've been stacking boxes and using these exact same layouts over and over again. We've all, these cookie cutters over and over again. And they are, you have these people show up who are like, they have no vision or imagination for something different. And they just assume that, okay, well, oh, I got another project to work on at work. Cool. Let me open up my OmniGraffle template for 960.js and start drawing my boxes because that's what a website is. And next thing you know, we're going to have, 20 years of stagnation or something when we don't, we could do better.
You're fighting that. You're leading the charge to do better. You've been doing a presentation at an event apart and I believe elsewhere called Modern Layouts Getting Out of Our Ruts, where you talk about all the experimentation that's gone on in print in the last 20, 30, 40 years versus the stagnation that we have on the web. And you talk about how new CSS properties for, are enabling all kinds of are enabling now or will soon enable
both
a big renaissance both okay
both yeah
talk yeah. about that a bit, like talk about the kinds of things we can do, the kinds of things we'll soon be able to do.
I'm super excited. I mean, I'm really excited about this stuff, and when I've been presenting it at conferences, people are super excited about
they go
it
watch. Yeah,
they go wild, which is so fun. It's really, I feel lucky to be able to present on a subject that people are so excited about because it makes it much more fun. So there's a bunch of different things, some of which are new CSS specifications, some of which are just, hey, we could have done this for a while now. Let me show you. I think we need just to breathe some new life into our ideas. Now that we've kind of gotten over the hump of responsive design, most of us have shipped several or many responsive websites. There's a lot that we had to figure out that we have already figured out. Like now that we're over that hump, what do we want to do next?
What do we want to do?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I honestly, like, if you look at the webahead.net, I feel like there are moments in here that are genius, and there's some stuff in here that's just so completely awful and boring when it comes to the page layout. And sometimes I'm proud of it, and sometimes I'm embarrassed by it, because I feel like it could just go so much further. You know, I need to get back to it and just keep messing with it, keep playing with it, keep experimenting until I get some breakthroughs in different parts and make it better. But so there's a bunch of things. One of them is CSS shapes, and people should listen to the web ahead. We've done shows on all these different things. I don't want to get into too much detail here, but CSS shapes lets you float something. So perhaps it's an image you're floating, or maybe it's a pull quote or something. You float a thing. Maybe it's an empty, invisible box. And then you tell the browser that you want the text or other content. It could be any flow content. It's easiest to imagine floating an image and having text wrap around it, but it could be something else. Typically, that text would then, the image would have the text wrap around it in a square, or a rectangle, I should say. You end up with a rectangular box. It doesn't matter what the image is. The image could actually be a circle, but the web browser pretends and expects that thing is a square or a rectangle. But shapes lets you change the shape of that floated object, and so that the flow content flows around it in a circle or in a triangle, in a trapezoid, in any sort of random shape that you want, in the shape of a beehive, in the shape of... and if we're clever about it, you can use this very simple bit of code, actually. It's super simple, the code that you write, to create all kinds of shapes on the page, to put your text in boxes that are not squares, not rectangles, to have triangles and circles and graphics, graphic shapes and elements on the page that were kind of impossible before.
Are you talking about, so for instance, text cutting in, let's say there's a photographic element, which is concave. There's like some white, triangular white space in that element.
Yeah.
And then you could have type flow along the concavity, so that like a magazine layout might do. Are you talking about that?
Yep.
And how does, if the image gets bigger or the page changes size, it just reflows?
Yep. In exactly the same way it already does. It's just that for now, I mean, in the past, it only would do that in the shape of a rectangle, and now it can do that in the shape of whatever you want.
There's, and I'm going to, I'll put this up on 5x5, but there's some nice stuff at Sarah Sudan and CSS Tricks and a list apart on CSS shapes.
Yeah.
And things you can do with them. And if you have any other resources, email me after the show.
Yeah, the web ahead is episode 81. Sarah Swaydon was on the show, okay. And we talked about shapes and a lot of other things. And there's a really great set of links on the show, on the page for that show. So that's at thewebahead.net/81. And then I have, if you go to labs.thewebahead.net, I've got a bunch of demos up there. The demos that go with the presentation that I've been giving. And there's a demo of shapes. And I use shapes all over the web ahead website.
Right.
Anytime you ever see, like if you go to the guests page, you go to any page for one of the guests. Anytime you ever see somebody's face, it's in a circle and there's text near it. And the text wraps around the circle in the shape of a circle.
And you put the code up at GitHub.
No, I didn't put the code for this up at GitHub.
The layouts ahead has a shapes demo or a patient.
Oh yeah, the demos are at GitHub. Yes, github.com/Simmons/thewebahead. The layouts ahead. Yeah, yeah. There's a repo in my GitHub account where all the demo. Yeah, because it's really easy to read code on GitHub. So I thought, oh yeah, and people can fork the repo and clone it and. Yeah, you fork the GitHub repo and then you can.
I know.
then you can mess with it. Then you can change it. And you can, mess around with it. You don't have to like copy paste my code. You can just have it.
What's the easiest way to find episode 81 on thewebahead.net?
Thewebahead.net/81.
I thought that might be the case.
Yeah. Yeah, shapes is cool. And shapes works today in half the browsers, and in the half that it doesn't work, you just get a nice fallback to a rectangle. It's not a
rectangle. there's other things that you talk about too in your presentation.
I talk about rotation because we're not using it and it's completely supported except for super old browsers, but we already know how to work around those browsers. And it, you know, it's a little tricky and it's funny on stage. I don't really go into the trickiness or the details of the trickiness, but it can be a little tricky and maybe that's why we haven't been using it. But, like I've been putting together a resume actually, and I'm making it in Keynote because Keynote is actually super easy to lay stuff out fast, much faster than Illustrator. And, I was like, oh yeah, let me put my name, Simmons. Instead of putting my name across the top of the page, I'll put my name down the side of the page. The name Jen is very short and the name Simmons is long. So I'll take Simmons and I'll just rotate it 90 degrees. So I have the name Jen in like really bold text, and you know, normal horizontal fashion. And then underneath it, I have the word Simmons completely sideways. And it lines up so that the S is the full length of the word Jen. And it runs down the page and I'm looking at this thing and I'm like, okay, this is going to become a PDF and it's going to live its life in an email. But what if I turn this into a website? It's like, I could do the same thing. I could take the word Simmons and put it giant down the side of the page, turned 90 yep. degrees by using a little bit of CSS that's been around for 5 years.
What about grid layout?
Yeah, grid layout. So it's in the talk. I don't have time to get into it, but I've been studying it more and more. Rachel Andrews has been talking about it a lot.
You did episode 49 with her.
Yes. I need to have her back on because that was a long time ago.
Yeah, that was a long time ago.
Grid layout looks amazing. I think it's going to make... So these days, lots of times we design a website, you're using a grid. Usually it's a 12-column or 16-column grid with column is the same width as every other column, which we don't have to be doing that, but that is what most people do. And then people reach for some sort of a framework. They use grid.js or they use, 960 grid.js or they use, they get into Bootstrap, blah, 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 whatever. And in some ways, I feel like sometimes the reason that people use a framework like Bootstrap is they don't know how to write CSS from scratch to do layout at all.
Right.
And they don't know enough about it to realize
that... Because it's gotten complicated.
Yeah, using floats, and then, you know, lots of times if you want to separate your source order from your layout, which we do, then you end up using techniques that, like, John Alvin Wilkins developed. He's got a thing called Zen Grids, which is a nice framework if you want to use a helper to get your code written. And he's been always really into using these, like, negative margins, and it's crazy. The CSS that you write is really crazy. And it's hard to write CSS like that. Even if you know how, it takes a while. So, let's just make a tool. We'll use a tool over and over again. That will make it easier. Well, grid layout is like, let's just get rid of all those crazy tools. Let's stop using floats. Let's stop using negative margins. Let's stop using all this kind of hacky stuff. And instead, we'll have a completely new way to write CSS where you write display grid instead of display block or display flexbox. You write display grid and it kind of toggles that unit of stuff on the page into this other mode. And then you define, here are my columns, CSS. These are what they are. I want this many columns and they're going to be, this one's going to be a fixed number of pixels. This one's going to be a percent. This one's going to be whatever amount of space you have left. This one's going to be, and then you can also define rows, which we've never really had the ability to do. Even with all our hackiness, we still don't ever try, even attempt to define rows. And then you can place things and you can say, I want this to be in the third column and in the second row. And I want this thing to be in the fourth column in the third row. And I want this thing to be, and you just tell it, go here, go here, go here, go here, go here. And it will put things in the right places on the grid that you've defined.
When I see, I've seen Rachel Andrew give a recent talk about this again, at a bit apart. And I was like, oh, all right, I'm going to love CSS again. And it'll be the first time in like 10 years that I've loved it. Because as CSS has gotten more capable, it's also gotten more complex. And in my own career, that coincided with me moving out of the front end into more strategic, whatever, you know, like business owner positions. So that I started losing hand skills just as the requirements for hand skills got much more complicated. And actually, yeah. I think I started getting turned off during the web standards revolution when we kept coming up with all these different, you know, has layout, and we kept coming up with all this stuff to make IE behave. I started just going, geez, you know, this is not what standards is supposed to be about. It's supposed to be about the stuff just works. And, you know, I started getting turned off and losing a passion for CSS. And when I see grid layout, I go, yeah, you know, I think that's going to bring it back. Because I'll be nice. Able to, right? Design for this medium, not for print, for this medium. Yeah. Using tools designed to do that.
Yeah. I mean, really, it's the first page layout CSS we've had in the history of the web.
Which is only 20 years old. And no, sorry, 25 years old. 25. It's been professional for, it's been professional for 20 years. And so...
it's amazing. So it's going to be super exciting. It's not in browsers yet. You can use it. You can mess around with it in Chrome. It's in Chrome behind a flag. Chrome has the most current implementation of it. It also is in Internet Explorer, but the version of the specification that's in IE is old, not because the people at Microsoft are lame, but because the people at Microsoft are awesome and they invented this. They invented it. They invented it and they put it in IE in order to show it to everybody else and to have a big, long conversation about it. So that conversation's been going on now for 3 years. And meanwhile, the specification has gotten better and better and better, which means that it's changed, which means that what's in IE is actually out of date. And they'll fix that at some point. They'll update it. But
it's the same thing that actually happened in the 90s when IE was the first browser to support CSS at all, in IE3. And they had the CSS gallery, and that's the thing that turned me on, like nothing else. It was 1996, and that's how I got inspired about web standards, when I saw the CSS gallery by Microsoft in 1996, and I'd hated Microsoft up to that point, and I thought IE was a joke until I saw that, they had done these amazing, beautiful layouts, and I mean, it was all hacky. Right, it was like
super hacky.
The same thing 5 times so that you could have, you know, a beveled effect, right? And then you'd use absolute positioning to stack the same text over and over in almost the same place. And that would create, like, you know, that would thicken the letter. I mean, it was totally hacked. But it didn't matter to me in 1996. In 1996, I wasn't even thinking about semantics. Nobody was. That wasn't possible. You know, the HTML Writers Guild was always thinking about semantics, and Sir Tim Berners-Lee was always thinking about semantics. Right. But the rest of us were just trying to make websites that look good. And
we wanted our bevels.
We wanted all that horrible stuff that we loved back then. But we weren't the only hack designers, because I look at old episodes of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and you look at the typography, and it's like, the 90s just kind of sucked. It's like the same thing that happens every decade. You look back, what were we thinking?
But the other thing that I think sometimes we don't give ourselves enough credit for is that if you looked at computer screens in the 90s, you know, the pixels were giant. They were so big you could actually see them. Literally, there they were. You could count them if you wanted to without even getting your eyes closer to the screen. And the amount of color that we had. We didn't have all of the colors. We just had...
There was 16, and then there was 216. 256, technically, but really 216.
Right. So we had 216 colors to choose from, to manipulate, to morph together. And then we had...
I mean, do you remember
it was
making...
It totally different.
Do you remember, like... getting one pixel in one 216 WebSafe color, then another pixel in a similar one, alternating pixels in two WebSafe colors, you could fool the eye into thinking there was a third color that wasn't WebSafe.
Yes. What was that called? Everything was like that. We did everything that way. Because there were only, you know, there were only 16 colors, shades of orange, and some of them were completely not what you wanted. They were really bright or really dark, and so you... You know, we were left with, 3 shades of orange that were kind of close to what you wanted. Literally, you'd have 3 colors of orange that you could choose from. And if you didn't want any of those 3, then you would, there's a word for it.
Pixelated, you'd have to make a background pattern. You'd make a background tile that had the color that you wanted, that simulated the color you wanted by alternating pixels. I just found a great, I'm going to put this in the page notes too, PageTutor.com. So you want to make a web page, web safe color chart. and the text is, of course, set in the image itself. It's weird because there's a side ad next to it that says you can help disaster victims. And it's an ad banner for American Red Cross. I find it hard to believe that the Red Cross is still advertising on this 20-year-old website. But maybe their hosting company just sticks ads in, right? Or maybe it's an old crisis.
It looks like these are Google ads. They've got the Google. They just plug this into Google.
Yeah, well, Google finds this. If you type 216, well, DuckDuckGo does. If you type 216 colors into DuckDuckGo, which yeah. I usually use because it doesn't...
Me too.
But we should say for people who don't know what it is, so that your search history isn't a matter of public record or isn't something that is being sold to advertisers.
Yep. Or corporations who are trying to use math and machines to design everything because they just want to sell stuff.
I wonder if you just type 216, what happens?
Yeah, I use DuckDuckGo too, I think. And I switched all my devices, my phone, my tablets over to it as well.
Yeah, I have my devices have a Google, a link to the Google web page. So that if I ever want to use Google, for instance, because I'm searching something that I've searched before, a related search, maybe about a musician that I've searched before, or a TV show, or an author, right? Those kind of things. Because I don't really care, who knows, you know, what season of Game of Thrones I'm watching. I don't think they can put me in Gitmo for that, but I'm untrusting about other things. Well, you and I have talked before as friends and also on your show about security and secrecy and all that. So we're not going to do that again.
Yeah, that was a good conversation. You were on episode 100.
Yeah. And in episode 101, you and Josh Clark talked about the Apple Watch before it came out.
102. Yes.
102, which is interesting because you're speculating.
Yeah.
And you're speculating minutes before the thing comes out.
Yeah, and we weren't speculating about, you know, oh, well, will the battery life be good enough? We were speculating about, you know, what kinds of apps, what will it be like to live with it? What kinds of apps are the right kind to design for it? As a space to be designed, you know, right. what is this thing?
Do you know if it's going to look like Space Jam?
I at that point I did, but I didn't put those two things together until I was working on the talk the very last time that I did it, and I looked down and I was like, because in this talk, for the 99% of the people listening who haven't seen it, I go through a little bit of the history of layout on the web, because most of us don't. We're not there. And for even those of us who were there, we don't think about it very much. It's very easy for the past to just kind of disappear. And it's helped me a lot in trying to understand where it is that we're going, to really think about where it is that we've come from. So I show people, it's also just very hard to find old web pages. It's so hard to find them. I've been searching and searching for them, and I have a very strange and eclectic collection. Many of the slides that I have are actually scans of books, because that's the only place I can find them is in books. So I have, you know, these black and white, horrible halftones, really crappy, absorbent paper. Yeah. But that's like the one and only, you know, screenshot I've got of that kind of website.
Still up. The Space Jam website is
Space
still up.
Jam is still up. So, and there are other, I went to the Computer Museum in Mountain View and I took a whole bunch of photos, because they've got a whole bunch of web pages that are like, basically they're just lit up on glass. They're not computers. They're just a picture, but it's not a photo. At least it's glass with a rear projection, so it looks kind of like a computer screen. So I have a bunch of those photos in there. And so Space Jam was one of them. And because Space Jam is still up, Microsoft homepage got relaunched in the last year or two, and some of the others. And so I'm
that
sort
was
of
the strangest
drawing,
thing. Sorry.
Seeing that.
Well, just that they made their homepage responsive and nothing else. They were rolling it out, they were rolled out a responsive redesign by redesigning the homepage.
Microsoft
the least did. The least visited page on most websites, the homepage.
Right.
So that you could go, hey, I can read this on my device. This is cool. And then click any link and you couldn't read it again. So it just seemed like a gesture to me.
Well, it was a beginning. I imagine it was the beginning of a shift of the culture inside the organization and such to do Microsoft.com homepage and to relaunch it as a responsive design. Yeah. And Paravel did that work.
Right.
And so they hired Paravel to also after.
Who am I thinking of?
Our three friends in Austin.
That's right.
Trent Walton, he was on the show and talked about all this. If people want to hear it, you can go check down the Trent Walton show.
Right. I was thinking of the number. It sounds like it, but it's the name of the glass ball in Lord of the Rings, and they just got acquired for $20 billion or...
Is it episode 80?
Okay.
So he talks about the new Microsoft homepage and whatever. But now we're totally getting off the rail. Not just in the presentation, but in a lot of the work that I'm doing these days, because I'm working on a all-day workshop about layouts. And I'd like to work on a book about this too. I'm just looking at, okay, what were we doing? What did we do in the middle? What are we doing now? How are some of the trends that we had at the beginning, they disappeared and then they come back, or this trend that we had in the late 90s disappeared and now it's back. And so there's a couple moments where I show sort of an old web page and a new web page. And I'm like, hey, look at this trend. It's sort of coming back again. I just want to inspire in people a fresh look at things.
And you totally do. It's a great presentation.
Thanks. And so as I was putting everything together, I looked at the Space Jam slide again for the millionth time. And I thought, that's the Apple Watch. So I went and grabbed a screenshot of a photo of the Apple Watch with the home screen of the Apple Watch. Because it's circles, you know, it's these. And when the moment I first saw the home screen of the Apple Watch and there were all these circles and they're very close together in that movement, the animation, when you move the your finger and you drag them, and sort of the ones that are in the middle are big and the ones on the outer edge of the screen are small. And as you drag it around, they grow or shrink according to their position on the screen. And that sort of sense of having circles and having touch areas that are circular and having those touch areas be sort of nested in with each other so that they kind of overlap. If you looked at them just horizontally, you drew horizontal lines, or you drew vertical lines, they're not lined up in a grid of squares completely separate from each other in space. They're sort of nested up close to each other. And that shape and those patterns, I'm like, it was very refreshing to watch the original unveiling of the Apple Watch UI, because it was like, oh, circles, a whole new, you know, because iOS is squares, in rows of squares.
New. And it's not new.
Yeah,
well,
and then
they must have been hinting at it. Remember when they started using circles instead of squares on, you know, if you go to like contacts, and they started that a while ago when they were irising in on stuff. They were probably telegraphing the design direction of the Apple Watch.
Yep. And associating people with circles with the Apple Watch.
But everything old is new again. You're absolutely right. And we have to go, and I'm so sorry, but
that went by fast.
Well, we've been going for an hour and 10 minutes and it was lovely. We got to go. So, there will be a whole bunch of links, on 5x5, but people can find you. You are Jen Simmons on, Twitter and jensimmons.com and
jensimmons.com. Yeah, if you want to look at a really bad website.
That's the one where you apologize for it?
That's the one, let me apologize and promise.
If you hate HTML here, I hate it even worse than you do. So, it's like, before you tell me to get off your lawn, I'm telling myself to get off my lawn.
Right.
Kind of like preemptive self-loathing or something.
I know. Yeah. I've got to fix that website. But whatever. Okay. Yes, you can go to jensimmons.com.
You and me both.
Yours is way better than mine.
I've been wanting to fix it for a long time. I have all these ideas. Yeah. But, I have a friend who invented Facebook, too. But they didn't execute it. So, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
The ideas are only worth so much. Yeah. Anyway, lovely to talk to you. We'll be having you on the show again soon. And meantime, of course, we'll be listening to The Web Ahead, where you really interview some amazing people and ask them absolutely brilliant questions. And it's just lovely.
Thanks.
Thank you, Jen, for making time for the show today. And thank you, DreamHost, for sponsoring the show. Thank you, 5x5, for hosting the show. Thank you, listeners, for listening. And we'll see you again soon on another Big Web Show. Next week, in fact. Bye-bye.